come, come. We have some test cases we need. everybody requires. That's the most difficult part.
A lot of different things, so some things may not be interesting. Sometimes this is what it means, but I don't know what we're doing. That's most people really enjoy. Three syllables, accents, Voxeo. People would otherwise say Voxeo, and it's supposed to be Voxeo. So I wrote it.
Good afternoon, everybody.
J'ai mis en F11, mais ça n'a pas marché. Là, c'est en... J'imagine qu'il faut que je fasse la définition.
T'as changé un truc.
Non, j'ai rien changé. Ben là, j'ai essayé.
C'est juste la branche
pied. Où est-ce que moi, je m'enlève en iPhone, ça? Voilà, on est 6.
If you ask if I was ready, then.
Because you looked like you were dozing off.
I was. Well, I was thinking about music notation, actually.
Sorry, I didn't interrupt you.
I could get excited about that. The ABC stuff? I would like to see if I can take a reasonable piece of music and actually make it look reasonable in ABC notation. Because then rendering that would, I mean, it would really be nice to be able to render music, publish it in the web, and be able to cut it and paste it into a music editing, I mean, as opposed to the scanning crap. I mean, the scanning, it's very bad because it makes mistakes and they're very difficult to correct.
And yet the extent of what is normal.
Thank you, Chris.
It's not that good. There are a bunch of those cases.
Okay, good afternoon, everybody.
Yeah, I mean, it could be cool.
When I took the position of being the chair for the day, the program committee chair for technical plenary day, I was informed that at key strategic moments during the day, I was required to summarize the earlier presentations for people that came late. So for those who missed the morning, I wanted to summarize what we learned. Integration is hard. HTML5 is cool. And there is life after HTML5. That's the summary. Speaking of this morning, I wanted to express my gratitude to, can't read here, to, here we go. So in order to make a conference come off correctly, there are many people that work very hard to make it happen. Some of them have their names in the limelight, and some of them work behind the scenes. The ones that have their names in the limelight are already posted, so I would like to collectively thank the program committee, all of the presenters, the session chairs, the moderators, everyone who participated in pulling together the technical program committee, the technical program. I will not mention them by name because their name is already mentioned, but thank you to all of you. It's more important to mention by name the people who work behind the scenes, who take care of all the logistics, make sure that we're able to register, eat, get all the systems running, and many other things that are required to run a conference. So I will read off a number of names. Hold your applause till the end. I'll ask the individuals to stand, and then we can applaud all of them. The only unfortunate thing about this part of the agenda is that since we are in Lyon, many of the logistical support elements are provided by people who are French. And I will now have the public embarrassment of pronouncing French names in my New York English, so apologize in advance. So please join me in thanking Alexandra Laverotte, Amy van der Heel, Nomi Yoshizawa, Vivienne Lacourba, Coralie Mercier, Caroline Baron. Some of the people that work on logistics are also on the program committee. Marie-Claire Ford. Jean-Guy Ruel. And helping from behind in the States, but not able to join us today, Susan Westhaver. This afternoon, with lightning talks and exciting discussions of web and TV, it'll be quite a different pace than this morning. And with that, I will turn it over to the session chairs, Marie-Claire Forg and to Karen Meyer.
Bonjour, bonjour à tous.
Bonjour.
Merci. So this is a lightning talk session, and actually this is a part one, because this year we received like a lot of requests, 15 proposals. So we'll start now, and we'll have a snapshot of incubator groups, running ones, closing ones, and new ones that will come. So quickly, you know that the rule is 3 minutes only, and I will ask Mark Schroeder from the FKI to give us his 3 minutes presentation. And then after the 3 minutes, we'll have only 2 minutes for questions. Thank you.
Okay, hi everyone. So I'm going to talk about emotion markup language, or the challenge of dealing with human factors. So let's start with the most important question: why do we need a computer-readable representation of emotions in the first place? And I think the most important answer to that is that people express emotions all the time when talking to each other. So you could say that emotions are the social glue of human experience. Now, that might not be obvious to the people in this room, predominantly male, highly intellectual, but if you think about your teenage kids, when they communicate and communicate over the internet, it's all about emotion, right? So that's probably the most important aspect. Then people's experience of technology is strongly affected by emotional reactions, and that is particularly true for non-experts. And then there's the argument of application developers wanting to enhance the user experience. So let me give you a few examples of emotion-related technology that is on the market today. And I want to distinguish three types: annotating emotion in some material, automatically sensing human emotion, and generating synthetic emotion-related behavior. So for annotating, here what you see is a screenshot of the Nico Nico Duga website, which is a video sharing website in Japan, which is highly popular. What's special about it is that people can annotate videos in real time, and other people can see that, so that creates a sort of community cohesion. Another annotation example is Mind Reading, which is an educational software for people with disability, like autism type, who cannot naturally interpret emotion-related expressions, so they can learn about how to make sense of people's behavior. Automatically sensing emotional behavior is done in a number of companies. What you see here is a screenshot of a company trying to make sense of facial expression while people are watching, for example, a test run of a commercial. So that's useful for consumer research, because you can link emotional behavior to events in the video. And in the picture and in the bottom, what you probably don't see very well is that the guy is wearing a wristband that is making sense, or recording the physiological measurements like heart rate and sweating and so on, and is interpreting that in real time. So a generation of emotion-related behavior examples are text-to-speech with emotion or animated characters on websites, for example, to help children find their way through a culture website or something. There's also a lot of work going on in research labs. I'm going to skip that. 20 seconds left. Okay. So we're in the middle of the work. We've done two incubator groups at the beginning. We're now working towards last call in the multimodal interaction working group. Two design principles, pluggability, so usability in many contexts, and scientific validity. If I can just... One last sentence. The discussion this morning was very interesting because when we think about what we need from web technology to make these things happen in browsers, we can see that the annotation and the generation work fine, but we're not quite sure. We seem to need this device type of recording capability for automatic recognition. Thank you.
Thank you. It never works. I mean, they always add a last sentence.
Okay.
1 minute for questions then. Please go to the mic. Yes.
Would you like your minute back?
Okay. So let me emphasize this point. Yeah? Emotion ML is so diverse that you want it to be able to use it in a broad variety of contexts, reflecting those various use cases. So that's why we went for a pluggable architecture. And the other point that is really important is that emotion is so easy to get wrong if you do it naively. So that's why we're really going to the scientists and using scientific descriptions of emotions. So that's the points I really want to drive home. Thank you.
Thank you.
So Harry Halpin, co-chair with Daniel Appelquist of the Social Web Incubator Group. Tim probably recognizes this slide from his past. So, of course, 2 years ago, we said W3C should get involved in social networking. We held a workshop in Barcelona, and an incubator group came out of it to study the vast area of social networking. After our, we've talked to people from Facebook, Google, hackers, all sorts of types, and the final results are there's possibilities, but right now things are looking somewhat grim. So social networking is no longer the Wild West. It's no longer experimental. It's not quite as fragmented as it once was. Actually, if you look at these maps of user statistics, essentially, Facebook's taking over. However, social networking is much larger than Facebook. The phenomenon is, of course, central to how we use the web. And almost every site has some kind of digital ID and authentication, which is central, the lowest level building block of the social web. And if you install a little plugin called FireSheep, you'll notice that almost every username, password, cookie combination is fundamentally insecure, incredibly easy to hijack. This is a tremendous problem that one of the basic art components of the web, identity, in the browser is fundamentally broken. Furthermore, it's not like people are not trying to address these issues. There's tons of work outside the W3C. We just list some of it here. However, there's not a coherent strategy of putting it into the one web platform. So we attempted to, after many months of deliberation, we wrote a final report saying, this is how we think it could be put in. I recommend you read the entire thing. We do attempt to summarize the entire social web space in 30 pages with a few pictures. But the findings are fundamentally that the W3C should investigate an identity system in the browser. There's been nice work by Chris Messina and Azar Raskin on looking at how it can be integrated in the browsers itself and make sure that a form of web identity is integral to the future development of the one web platform. That we the DAP working group has been working very heavily on coordinating the core of profile data so we can actually access our profile data in a uniform manner across different applications. Ultimately, the social media is growing. You have issues with digital rights management. You have people getting letters being fined for downloading movies. We need to work heavily on combining the social media and a lot of the work on the semantic web together so that these sort of problems as regards to consumption and production of social media can be solved. We recommend highly that the W3C commence an overarching privacy activity looking at social web use cases. There's been quite a few workshops on this. We expect a lot more activity in the near future. If you are doing decentralized social networking, we're seeing really exciting developments, test-driven development of decentralized social networking tools allowing Google Buzz to talk to diaspora. People from Facebook have got involved in the early meetings to talk to people from BT. That's the Federated Social Web effort. We're going to support that as an incubator group. And lastly, one of the reasons a lot of this exciting work around digital identity and the social web has not come to W3C earlier was, of course, perceived, sometimes true, sometimes not, barriers to participation, and therefore we believe that the community group proposal on opening the World Web Consortium will make it more friendly to all this innovation and many developers. So we're very pleased with the ability to present this to W3C, and if there's any questions, fire away now.
There's one.
Dan Applequist, your esteemed co-chair.
Thank you.
Just to reiterate Harry's point, please ask us about the contents of the report. I think it articulates some pretty, I think, important ideas about what W3C should be doing in this space. And also just to reinforce what you said about the risks inherent in the way that people currently identify themselves on the web. I just managed to get Fire Sheep to work, and already, even given the network problems that we have right now, I can, with one click, I could impersonate Ambassetti on Twitter if I wanted to right now. So,
yep,
that's it. That's the risk.
So basically, if these privacy and security and identity issues are not addressed within the web, this has the chance, as I think Jonathan Zittrain put it, of being the sort of I-9-11, which could possibly cause a lot of people to go towards more and more closed platforms. If we want to keep the web as an open platform, we have to address privacy, identity, and security in a coherent manner with the rest of web architecture. So.
Next up, am I on? Okay, next up we have Dan Burnett from Voxeo. Dan is the co-chair of the HTML Speech XG Incubator Group.
All right, if you have handy a mobile device that is able to browse the web and on which you can enter information, please hold it up, only if it's handy. All right, now keep your hands up if you are also able to enter information on it using your voice, using speech. Okay, now keep your hands up if you're able to do that in those apps. Use only standards. What? Yeah, put them down, exactly. Right? So that's what we're doing. It's not changing pages. Yeah, do you stop my timer?
Still running.
Okay, all right. So we started the HTML Speech Incubator Group a couple months ago. We have some participants from some of the major visual browser companies, as well as the main speech recognition and synthesis companies. That's voice recognition technology for those of you who aren't yet in the know. We have some other others as well. Of course, we'd like to have some other folks involved. Please join us. So far, we've collected a beginning set of use cases, also some requirements and proposals. We're going through the requirements right now. Some of the most interesting issues have come up around security and privacy because, again, this is your voice. So people often have opinions about when and where their voice should be recorded and what it can be used for. And then also exactly how you access resources, speech technology resources. Should they be something that's actually built into the browser, chosen by the browser? Is it something the web application developer gets to choose? Does the user get to choose? So those are some of the biggest topics that have come up so far during this TPAC meeting. We're interested in other requirements and other participants. So after we prioritize the requirements, of course, we're going to work on a proposal. I don't have fancy results to show you because we're just getting started. So again, others are welcome in case you haven't heard that yet. And when we're done, we actually plan to propose this to HTML. Now, we don't know which group that'll be. I guess we're hoping that that will become clearer within the next year that the group was chartered. Probably not, but hey. So what is it that we do? We are hoping to put speech technologies into HTML. And we would like for you to join us. Any questions? If not, I can answer one. Okay, there is, there's one question that I have been asked pretty often personally, and that is, how is this related to VoiceXML? It is a separate group and separate activity from VoiceXML. This work is actually intended to create a very lightweight and simple API that goes into HTML. VoiceXML was designed originally to deal better with longer-term spoken dialogues. So that's the focus is a little bit different, and we're still working out exactly where the boundaries are there. But definitely the focus here is on a lightweight API to go into HTML.
Thanks so much, Dan.
So our next speaker is Roger Cutler from Chevron, and we're moving into the next two talks around the integration of data theme. Semantic web in the oil and gas industry.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I'd like to give you a broad brush and somewhat speculative view of why we're interested in the semantic web in the oil and gas industry, at least in Chevron. Well, what makes the semantic web different? It's because it's designed for wide web requirements. I put these things I can't pronounce. One way that it is designed that way is it's supposed to be scalable, but the other, which is more interesting, is that it's designed to deal with the open world assumption. So is in a closed world, I think that the appropriate technologies are the ones that we're very accustomed to using, procedural programming and data, relational databases. But in the open world, I think the web technologies are more appropriate, which I think includes the semantic web and probably social computing, but that's a different subject. So is our world open or closed? Well, within a domain, I think it's closed. We have control of our information, and we know how to deal with it. Across domains, it's open. Drilling, production, reservoir management, and maintenance all have information about wells, but they all keep the information differently. And of course, across companies and joint ventures or with vendors, it's closed also. Now, what I'm talking about are data silos, and everybody knows data silos are bad, evil, and we've known that for many years, and so what do? We have these huge mega projects to make mega silos, and we put incredible resources into doing that. I've wasted years of my life doing this, and then we wonder why nobody comes and uses them, but it just doesn't work. The semantic web solution seems to be to love silos, to accept them. They've been developed to be very effective ways of using the information for what they're meant for in the business, but to connect them and to recognize that the data is organized differently and appropriately in silos and to connect them using ontologies. To make a linked data cloud. This is the HCLS linked data cloud. I think our oil and gas situation is different from HCLS and e-government in some significant ways. Here are some of the semantic web activities that we have in Chevron, a couple of which I've obfuscated. And they're all kind of point solutions, but more recently we've been looking at developing an integration architecture to try to actually integrate across different domains and actually do something. Now we haven't done this yet, but hopefully this will work and it'll be great. So
thank
I actually
you,
came in under 3 minutes,
yeah.
Didn't I?
Yeah, good. Questions for Roger? Thank you. Ayan, that's a question for you.
Can you describe, Roger, what it's like inside Chevron communicating the beauty of semantic web technology to your colleagues?
Well, actually, the semantic web, the idea of using the semantic web in Chevron has gained a considerable traction, and it is highly visible with our executives. It's recognized as a research direction and a potential direction for the future. There are two reasons for that. One is that thus far, what we've emphasized is what you can do with it right now, and we're looking at point solutions where we're exploiting its expressivity and inference to do metadata, essentially to do metadata management. But also, these large-scale integration capabilities have their right in the center, strategically, of some of our big projects, like in particular upstream workflow transformation, which is talking about workflows which span domains. And we're trying to understand our business workflows and the information management involved with it. And so it resonates, the big picture resonates very strongly with them. Did that answer your question?
Thank you.
And continuing the theme of integration and data, Ashok Malhotra from Oracle will be talking about mapping relational data to RDF.
Okay. I'm going to speak to you very briefly about the RDP to RDF working group. What we are doing is we are going to write a standard. We are actually going to write two standards, mapping relational data to RDF. Once you write the mapping, you can actually take the data, store it, or you can do a virtual mapping, which you can query using Sparkle, and the Sparkle will get translated to the SQL for the database. Why are we doing it? Why are we doing this? Because there's a huge amount of relational database. Businesses run on it. The world runs on it. But it's not with the web. These are two completely different worlds. And we'd like to bring them together. That's a big argument. Secondly, relational data wants this kind of technology because it wants to add semantics. It wants to add rules, and then typically, very often, relational data is built in silos and is got to be integrated. Okay. Next slide. Let me skip this. We started with a workshop. We did an XG, and we started roughly 12 months ago. We have a requirements and use cases document. We have just published a customized mapping document. Customized mapping lets you use the full power of SQL to actually translate from relational data to RDF. And within the next month or two, we're going to publish the first public working draft of the default mapping. Default mapping is what a lot of people want, which means you have a fairly simple database. You go in there, you press a button, RDF comes out of it, right? Simple, no-brainer. And then maybe we will write a formal semantics document. I am not going to hold up the other stuff. If we get this semantics, great. If we don't, we'll move on. And I think that's the end. Oh, there's some details about customer. I'm done. Thank you.
Any question to Ashok? Yes, we have. Going to the mic.
Okay. Hi, my name is Arthur from Yahoo. I have a question. When you are moving information from your silos up to RDF to the semantic web, in the silo, it's quite easy to find a unique ID for a person you have in your database. So if you have a Tim Berners-Lee in your database, you know which person it is. But probably in the semantic web, you probably find two of them or three of them. And how do you deal with unique IDs you have quite clearly in your silo and when you're going to combine it with open data?
Thank you. That's it. Terrific question. That was a sorry. That was on my last slide, which I skipped. This is a very difficult question. And we have for the default mapping, we have a scheme to generate URIs. But this is an open question that we are working on. And there are people like the OCAM project and stuff, they want us to work with them and so on. So next year I will tell you the answer. Okay. Anything else?
Anything else from the table? No. Okay, so thanks so much, Ashok. Thanks a lot to our panelists. And
Yes, and then stay tuned for the next session, Web on TV. And then after that, we will have a break. And then we will come back to the additional lightning talks, where we'll continue discussions about the look, feel, and sound of the web.
Thank you.
Question? Yes, please ask.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to say I'm Henry Story. I've been working on the social web XG, and I'm trying to get a web ID working group going. So that solves a lot of the problems that Harry was speaking about. And if people can just that is security, distribution, identity, and it's discussed on that. So since I'm here and I'm in France, it's a good time to come and see me.
Can I comment on that? Can I comment on that? Is this open? That I'm from a enterprise standpoint, I'm kind of hoping that that kind of question can be sort of a push and pull, and be influenced by our efforts in master data management and our efforts to understand in a systematic way our business processes. So I don't view that as entirely necessarily a technical question of how you do it automatically, but did that make sense? Is that responsive at all to this issue?
Web ID is extremely specific, very very low technical solution for identity that works in the browsers currently, and it's just a very light specification that's needed. We already have it, really.
So we are planning on looking, of course, at Henry's work with the OpenID Foundation, Kantara Initiative, and all sorts of identity groups. So I know that a lot of people here, maybe you're not doing identity work, but probably I would assume people in your company are. It would be really good to talk while you're here. So it's very important, and W3 is very interested in working with all sorts of parties and getting the use cases and requirements right.
I think today is a day when I've seen a first talk about that's talking about semantic web and so-called open data with a redacted slide. Thank you, Roger. That's absolutely fantastic. I tweeted that you had a redacted slide. Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Phil Archer. I'm on the W3C team. I've been involved in various things in this forum over the years, both as a member and now on the team. The reason why I'm here today is twofold. First of all, my role in W3C is part of a project called Open Media Web, one of our European Union-funded projects, which is looking at all sorts of rich media on various devices. So it covers a bit of mobile, covers a bit of SVG, it covers HTML5 in terms of applications, and the relevant thing this afternoon is it covers video and TV on the web. In a previous life, before I got involved in anything like this, I used to work in local radio. And because I used to work in radio, they thought I'd be good at chairing a panel on TV. I don't know why, but still. A large panel, as you see, this reflects the fact that the general subject of the web and TV is one that is gaining an awful lot of attention from different companies. Different companies that don't necessarily work together, certainly some of them are relatively unfamiliar in the web space. And yet we're coming together today to talk about this in this way. They will all introduce themselves. There'll be no PowerPoint slides. I'm not going to have six presentations all the 50 minutes. This is a discussion, and I very much hope that you will be involved in that discussion too. But I will introduce them as we go along. First of all, on my immediate left, your right, is my team colleague. I know him simply as Kaz, but if I read his name properly, it's Kazuyuki Ashimura, who organized a recent workshop on the web and TV in Tokyo. He'll be talking about that. Tristan Fern from the BBC, Libby Miller, also sort of BBC affiliated, but part of an EU project called NoTube, which you'll talk about. Yosuke from Tomo Digi, he'll be talking about what that organization is from Japan. Dong Yong from LG Electronics, which in the space of here means we're talking about TV device manufacturers, although Dong Yong has an interest in mobile particularly, I know. And somebody from America, just to sort of have some American input here, Mark Vickers from Comcast, an enormous video cable provider. So those are the panel. They have various things to say about the web and TV. Notice, by the way, I'm not talking about the web on TV or TV on the web. Which way around you take that depends on your point of view. We're going to be looking at both sides of that as we go along. So Kaz, as you're nearest, could I ask you to start? Give us a brief summary, if you would, of the workshop you held in Tokyo in September, and maybe look ahead to a repeat performance in Berlin next year.
Oh, that's fine. Yeah. Okay. Yes. So we held W3C workshop in September on web on TV. And we discussed the use cases, possible use cases, and the requirements for smarter integration of TV technologies and web technology. And actually, there were 150 people for the workshop, and we gathered many nice and difficult and kind of complicated use cases and requirements for future possible television and web relationship. Yeah, and the conclusion from the workshop included our launching a new dedicated interest group for these topics, and now Philip Hoshka, the Ubiquitous Web Domain Leader, is bringing the proposed charter for the interest group to W3C management meeting. That is the situation.
Thank you. So we'll be talking about the interest group as we sort of get towards the end, and encouraging you to join that if this is something that is of interest to you. Thank you. Tristan, could you tell us a bit about your work at the BBC? Like me, a fellow radio man at heart, and tell us a bit about how it fits in with your work here, please.
I work for BBC Research and Development in a prototyping team where we build prototypes somewhere in the intersection of the audience and technology. And that can be on TV, on web, on radio. My background was in radio, so when we're talking about TV, don't forget like radio as well. Obviously, the BBC is interested in how to deliver TV on the web and in the browser. So iPlayer is our catch-up TV service. Also interested in how to deliver kind of web-enabled applications on TVs, set-top boxes. So what was Canvas, now known as UView, which is a UK system for IP-connected TV, launching next year. That's the BBC. Personally, in my job, I'm particularly interested in how we create new experiences that combine the best of TV and the best of the web. And the kind of things which I worry about around that are how can we kind of join up the relatively passive audiences that primetime TV gets with the kind of active interconnectedness of web users. How do I get the hugely talented people in the BBC who kind of make amazing TV programs and tell amazing stories to engage with the possibilities of the web? And what does that mean for their programs? Can we kind of join up search and recommendation stuff that is used on the web with TV and schedules and the archive of TV programs and things like that? Right now, my team's working on building a second screen experience. So whilst you're watching TV, have something else happening on your laptop which is synchronized with the program which is on right now. And we're kind of working on an experiment with a nature program in the BBC, in the UK.
Thank you. Moving on to Libby, those of you who know Libby in person or by name will know that she's been involved with Linked Data and Semantic Web for a very long time. In that context, she is famously a friend of Dan Brickley. So can I please introduce Libby Miller from the NoTube project?
Hi. Can you hear me okay? So the NoTube project is an EU project. It's a large one. And our part of it is about social media and TV. And the web. So social web and TV, I think, is the official line. In our part, we're really interested in how people are using TV at the moment. So they're using second screens. They're interacting a lot with social media as they're watching TV. And they're also interacting with people in the same room. Commonly, people still tend to watch TV with other people in the same room. So given those kinds of behaviours, my interest is in how we can make TV more engaging and more interesting than it is already. And we're doing that by creating prototypes and things like that. So, for example, finding gems of programmes throughout the programme lifecycle. So if I see some incredible programme on BBC Four and I want to tell people about it, like how do I make that easier? Archival programs, how do we find interesting content within very large archives using metadata and various measures? And we've been making prototypes to do with real-time voting on programs that everyone's watching, but also these kinds of interestingness stuff for long-tail programs and the sort of supporting services that those need. For example, the links between broadcast TV and URLs. So my personal interests and the interest in this part of NoTube are in APIs to TV and metadata for TV, and specifically resolvable URIs for TV, because those are the kinds of things that people like to share on social media.
Thank you, Libby. So far, going along this line here, we've had sort of web people, semantic people, cool application broadcasting people. The far end, we start getting down to the, I don't, down is the wrong word, sorry, along to, horizontally towards the actual broadcasters and people involved much more about with traditional television and traditional ways of thinking about broadcasting, who are coming to the W3C to look at how we might be able to help in terms of augmenting the TV experience. So Yusuke Funahashi from Tomo Digi, Tomorrow Digital, I believe is where that word comes from. Can you tell us about your organization and introduce yourself, please?
Okay. Hi, I'm Yosuke Funahashi from Tomoji Corporation in Japan. Let me introduce our company, Tomoji, a little bit. My company's purpose or mission statement is web and TV convergence itself. Our company was established in 1999. That year was when digital broadcasting, interactive services on TV with web technology started in Japan. Now we have over 120 million DTV sets in Japan, and we are actually doing vast range of interactive services with broadcasters and telecom companies. I believe this is an important fact. We actually did and are doing many services to many people. What we know is reality, reality of the market. What we know is not an academic fact, not a plan, not a technical dream, but the market fact about web and TV. I'd like to explain my interest in web and TV interest group. In this place, I'd like to comment about conceptual or architectural aspect of web and TV. Web is, I think, originally the spatial, conceptually spatial concept, but TV is not spatial, a more temporal concept. TV broadcasters align their programs in timeline. So that is very different things. But when the digital television started, the convergence of web and TV slightly started. But unfortunately, at that time, there are several kinds of web standards. Basically, TV broadcasters developed their specification based on web standards and broadcast extensions, many APIs for HTML and CSS and DOM. But at that time, there are several kinds of web standards. For example, XHTML 1.1, HTML 4.01, not web standard, but there is also a Java-based. Broadcasters in the world extend the specification in each of the countries, and there are many dialects in the TV industries about the specification of browsers. I think now is the time of convergence for TV industry or TV broadcasters. Because the HTML5 is coming. So based on HTML5, TV broadcasters should now to consist of one TV, like one web. I think this is a time to make one TV. And one web and one TV will be something new, something, oh, just a minute, something what really new thing brings us some new technology. That is a conceptual aspect of web and TV interest group. Thank you.
Thank you, indeed. As someone who's been working quite a lot in the mobile space, and I've been involved in writing documents and talking about the concept of one web, the idea of one TV, I think is a really good idea. Good luck with that. So can we move on to Don Young Lee from LG Electronics, manufacturers of devices. This is something that came out in the lunch BOF meeting just now. You think of something like a mobile phone or a PC, the product cycle of those things is maybe 3 to 6 months. TVs, people buy them and they keep them for 10 years, which has a big, big effect on the way we have to think about the technology inside those devices. So, Don Young, can you tell us a bit about LG Electronics and what you'd like to see happen?
Yeah, thank you. I hope you all know my company, LG Electronics. We make cell phones and TV sets. And I'm here to say that we want some web technology as the platform for so-called smart TV for our product. And also there is, I want three properties. First, free. I believe you all know what it means, which is IPR free, because there are existing standards defined by some other SDOs. But one reason they are not really used is because people are afraid of the IPRs that may be behind them. And the first property we want is unfragmented, because we are doing global business, so we don't want some specification for some market and another for another market and another for, again, another market. And the last one is realistic standard, which means that, so we already have a free and on what so-called OneWeb, which is HTML5 and other technologies used on PC, but we cannot really use it TV of at least today, right? Because there are many reasons. TV is usually very resource limited, and it's hard to upgrade, and the screen is big, and it has a very limited input, and the user typical user experience is very different, so-called lean back user experience. So yeah, we want new standard in W3C, which is free and unfragmented and realistic. That's what we want here. And we are willing to work on such a standard here.
Thank you, Dongyang. So that's a direct call for some web standard for some standardization work from a major TV device manufacturer. The point there being that your new TV may have an RJ45 port, but the processing power and the memory available within that device is very limited, because so much of the technology is focused on delivering the video experience that the web side of things may be nice and cool, but it comes a very long way down the track of things, because the important thing is you're going to get a good picture for your viewers. So last but by no means least, Mark Vickers from Comcast, please.
So I got involved in web and TV standards some time ago. In 96, I joined a spin-off of Netscape that was designed to take that technology into TVs and other devices. And we eventually ended up delivering that on some millions of TV set-top boxes and learned a lot about that. We spun off some standards back then, some early standards like that some of you may remember, like ATVEF, which was about how to deliver web technology over television signals, web pages and URLs. There's a TV colon URI that, for referencing TV programs that got published by the IETF. And there are a bunch of JavaScript extensions that got published through SMPTE. I'm pretty sure not a single bit of which got into HTML5, so that's what happens when you're too early, I guess. My current company, Comcast, is really, when I started there 5 years ago, was focused on delivering TV to set-top boxes, but is now very much all about delivering any content to any device, anytime, and anywhere. And as part of that, it's really leading us towards HTML5 by moving the applications up into the cloud and basically trying to have a flexible AJAX protocol to deliver to different devices. We now deliver to the web, but obviously through plugins like Flash, but we're very interested in being able to develop an HTML5 target. And for us, I would echo what some of the other members just said, that we're really interested in there being one web that for both PC, mobile, and TV, and for one HTML5 to go across that. And we think that those standards, it's only going to happen if those standards and the support needed for TV is done at the W3C itself. Otherwise, we have proprietary extensions like my old company or various standards dribbled across half a dozen different agencies, which is what we have today. There's all sorts of TV web extensions in different groups, and now we're finally getting them in the core of HTML5 at the W3C. I'd just say that HTML5 looks very promising. We've really been studying what it's going to take to deliver all of our services through that. The video tag is obviously critical. Time tracks, recently added, look like they're going to be critical for delivering a lot of what we need. Canvas and WebGL are very important for getting accelerated graphics on low-power devices. WebSockets is critical and is a great addition. And actually, just all the work on implementations that have sped up JavaScript to make it viable for, you know, highly interactive applications. There's a few challenges I'll just throw out. One of them was going to be about key codes, but due to some recent work by that looks like we've got some work going towards getting that in the next reference of CSS3. There's still need to figure out a way to get access to local content on the LAN. To get access to recorded programs from other set-top boxes, there's no way to do that kind of access. And there's some alternatives we need to talk about. There's other challenges which are really outside of the W3C but also have to be solved, like how to get codecs that'll support the kind of standards we need to support for regulations like closed captions and all those, plus to have protected video. And I know that codecs and things like that are outside of the W3C, but all of those have to be sort of orchestrated together in order to use HTML5 as opposed to existing proprietary plugins. I think my time's up. But
all right, thank you, Mark. So the recurring themes along the whole panel here is the idea of multiple screen involvement, multiple devices, and the traditional model of sitting down watching TV relatively passive isn't going away. It's simply that now the facility exists to do something alongside that, and ideally that is in some way related. Libby, can I ask you to talk a bit about the way that hashtagging and Twitter is used, particularly on BBC programs and Question Time and that kind of thing, and the kind of social networking effect you're seeing of TV programs that get talked about on the web?
I should hedge my remarks in the sense that I think this is really just a UK phenomenon, but I would really like to know if it also happens elsewhere, because a huge percentage of the people who are on Twitter also watch TV while they're on Twitter, so it's very high in the UK, to the extent that for certain programs, you'll get 8 of the 10 trending topics in the UK will be to do with one program, or you'll get 5 or more to do with different programs at the same time. And I'm not sure whether that's just because, as someone remarked earlier, we've got nothing better to talk about, or whether it's because we have relatively few channels with quite a lot of people watching just a few of the many channels, rather, something like that. But it's very interesting that some programs are beginning to pick up on this. They're giving the hashtags before some programs. And just in general, people are having quite excited conversations where they're talking at the TV through the medium of Twitter. So I think it's an interesting phenomenon, and sometimes you see even more interesting things happen. I've talked about this before, but when the Digital Economy Bill went through Parliament in the UK, there was a very boring debate about it where a lot of people were wrong and some were right. But there was a kind of chorus behind them of people on Twitter and in other places adding links, discussing it, shouting at the TV, but also a bit more than that, saying something else about what was happening, adding relevant information and linking to things that were of interest. So basically making the TV more fun. So you get these two aspects, one of which is just a kind of, you know, the kind of shouting at the telly that you do when you're at home, when you're watching perhaps a game show or something like that. But the other one's a bit more interesting to me because it gives more information and that can be reused later.
Do other countries have this phenomenon where when a major TV program is on, Twitter is flooded with information about that? So me being a British person, the main political debate program that goes on, as the program begins, there's the hashtag you're meant to use if you're commenting on it. There are comedy programs as they begin, the hashtag comes up on the screen and so on. Is that something that happens outside Britain as well, or is it a funny thing that English people do? It's a funny thing English people do. Okay, fair enough. Well, you know, we do that. Kaz?
Yeah. Actually, I thought, yeah. So in Japan as well, so TVS, Tokyo Broadcasting Station, yeah. So also did some collaboration between Twitter and TV program for Japanese prime minister vote, right?
Election.
Yeah. Prime minister election, yeah. That special program. They used collaboration between Twitter and TV program, actual TV program for digital television. So do you have any idea or information about that?
The purpose or intention of that program is the program brings the people not currently using the web. For example, all the people not yet accustomed to web and Twitter, that program brings such kind of people. What happens on the Twitter by broadcasting? So on the net, many people tweet about the election or politician or such kind of things, and the broadcaster broadcasts such that content via electromagnetic wave to TV sets. And if TV sets are not connected to net, they can view the content of the Twitter. That is the purpose of that program.
So we talked a lot about the interaction, but what people are doing now is having these two separate devices. I've got a device probably in my hand or on my lap that is a web thing, and I might be tweeting or doing something else or otherwise socially interacting. And I've got this other separate device in the corner of the room which is showing me the program. So Dongyang, can you tell us a bit about what you would like to see happening from an LG perspective? Would you like to be able to sell a TV packaged with your own tablet? Or the remote control that's also your phone, or what? What do you want to see?
Of course, we make a TV, but we make mobile phone and tablet as well. So that use case is very interesting to us. And I actually think that we may develop the technology a little more so that if we use Twitter, the TV content and the stream of information like HTTP links are kind of loosely synced, right? So we cannot really have precise and exact link or sync between two streams of information. So for example, we cannot really point that the earring that that person is wearing or that castle at time 7 p.m. 15 26 second or things like that. And also each kind of one way we can only put additional information to video content on TV, but if we just use something like a Twitter, we cannot do the other way. So it's kind of hard to incorporate the what user is doing on his mobile phone or tablet and reflect it to the video content. So we may want something more advanced to just using Twitter. And that's one thing that we could explore here in the long term, okay? Yeah. Our priority is standardizing the extensions, more specifically the APIs, but in addition to that, we could explore those interesting user use cases and advanced technologies as well.
So if the APIs were in place, you could do something a lot smarter, a lot more interesting than simply following a program on Twitter, I think is a very simple summary of what you were saying. Thank you. Mark, could you tell us a bit about what happens now? You were telling me over lunch about the EPG on an app and how that interacts with the TV. And also, can you put that in the context of Comcast, this very, very large cable company, about to make a big acquisition, which I think is itself technically interesting?
Well, the application we've been showing recently is a guide on an iPad where you can interact and choose the television programming and click on the iPad and end up changing the channel while you're watching TV. And it's really just one example of what we call two-screen interactions. And I think we're doing it for channel changing, but I think what gets more interesting is, we were talking about a little bit over lunch, is when programmers, that is to say not computer programmers like us, but television programmers, start using this as an integral part of the program they design. Studies show that above a certain age, people are just watching TV, but below a certain age, the majority actually always have a PC or some other device with them as they're watching TV. It's very much the exception not to. And so nobody's really programming to that now, but you could really be designing shows where the interaction you would be doing sort of with the device, the screen in your hand, would connect directly with the screen on TV. And, there's really good examples of that in the video game world now, where you can get like a Nintendo handheld and connected, doing some things with two people connecting with a game while it's going on the big screen main console. And I think things like that are going to be interesting coming to programmers as well.
Your phone as your remote control.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not very far away, which is really good. And the bit you didn't answer, but do you mind if I tell people about the acquisition you're making? Or do you want to tell people about that?
I think a lot of people know this. I mean, Comcast is a cable company, so we deliver television over cable and internet services, but we also have some own some programming channels like the E Network, which is known in the U.S., probably not too well outside the U.S., and we're in the process for most of the last year in acquiring NBC and Universal Studios. And again, I think it's just that we know that all of this content, whether it's DVDs or television programs or anything in between, is all going to be available in soft form on the web that you can download and access, again, anywhere you want through any device. And so that kind of convergence in delivery is naturally leading to some convergence in the way the companies are formed as well.
Thank you. Very shortly, I'm going to be asking for questions from the floor. So if you have a question, please feel free to come to the microphone and start queuing up. If you don't have any questions, I'm going to feel very down and sad. So please, think of questions. Tristan, can I come to you? We heard about you by reputation as being this cool guy with some really cool stuff at the BBC, which it's now is your chance to shine, as it were. We've heard about these multi-device things, interacting with the in an exciting way with the mainstream media coming down. So can you do some blue sky thinking for us in terms of how you would, if the APIs were there, what would you like to be possible? Whether someone's digesting a radio program or a TV program. And can you perhaps sort of sketch out where some of the gaps may be in the technology that we might want to try and fill?
So I guess I normally think about what we can do with existing technology. So it's quite interesting being here where you're kind of inventing new technologies. That's quite interesting. Things which we're looking at. I mean, there's a lot of kind of second screen type experiences which are around game shows and quizzes and social type interactions, which are kind of really obvious things to do with TV. The thing we're looking at the moment is what you'd do with factual TV. So given documentaries about nature, then what kind of extra information or experiences would you want on your laptop or your iPad or your tablet, which could kind of make that more interesting. That's one way of looking at things. Radio, that's quite interesting because it has massive audiences in the UK anyway, particularly at particular times of day, and they're live, and it's a particular experience of kind of listening to a DJ and knowing that everyone else in the country is listening to that DJ as well. And so there's definitely social stuff around that one could do. As well as extra information, which you could deliver via the web. What was the second part of the question?
Oh, you're doing fine. It's a general sort of blue sky thing. What would you like to see that isn't there now in the technology?
What gaps are there and stuff? I mean, kind of challenges in combining TV and the web. Things like representing, finding, and recommending TV content, which is done pretty well on the web for web content. Are there specific things we need to do for TV there? How do you synchronize TV and web content, whether that's kind of on-demand content or live content? And that kind of that amount of synchronization depends on the kind of application which you want, which you're looking at. So whether it's kind of, if it's just delivering a picture which is relevant to the program, then maybe that doesn't have to be that synchronized. But if you're talking about things like subtitles or closed captions, which could be delivered over the web to a device for accessibility reasons, then those need to be kind of really quite tightly synchronized. So there's a number of challenges there, I imagine. How's that?
That's interesting. You're talking about synchronizing, and you mentioned sort of maybe how can you do social media around radio. It so happens that my name is the same name as that of a character who appeared in the longest-running drama series in the world. It began in 1951, and the character who has my name only died last year. So because I have this name and this radio program, which is called The Archers, has been going all this time, I'm in a Twitter community of people who tweet about the radio program regularly. So, all right, I tweet about farming and that kind of thing because it's a program about farming. However, because a lot of us listen to that program time-shifted on iPod, like rule one of the Twitterverse when you're talking about that is you don't give plot spoilers. And tweeting about a program that and without giving plot spoilers has been really hard. And someone last week tweeted something about Spooks, which was on Monday night, and I haven't seen it yet. And if they told me the ending before I get to see it, I'm going to be really fed up. That wasn't a problem before we had time shifting and delayed stuff, but it's a problem now. Okay, the floor is open to questions. If anybody wants to ask questions to any of the panelists about anything we're hearing, please do come up to the microphone and ask your question. In the absence of that, I'm going to keep on asking questions. I don't know if Jeff's coming out to do that or just going to go and find the little boys' room or something. Oh, and Charles, what a surprise! Mr. Cathy Neville from Opera has a question. This has never happened before.
Charles from Opera, and I'm going to run away as soon as I've asked it so I can scribe my question. The web potentially has a lot to do for accessibility. You've started to mention things. TV actually has a lot of accessibility already. So what are the things that TV already does that are sort of the minimum things we have to do to not be worse than what we already have on TV, and what more can we get beyond that from moving to the web or adding the web?
I can address some of that. It's interesting because for us, these accessibility requirements, a lot of them, they're governmental regulations, so they're things we have to do from day one to be running. So there's captions, closed captions called in U.S. subtitles, which are required to be there. There's also parental control, which is not really an accessibility issue, but it's also mandated by the government that there's a system wherein every TV is required that you can program it at home so that it could reject content above a certain level of rating automatically. That's a built-in requirement to every TV sold in the US. LG has to do this. And if we start delivering to web, chances are those same requirements will be, when the government wakes up to it, will be required. So we're making sure we can deliver that as well. There's also second audio channel that's also required to be able to support in the US case, mostly Spanish language programming. There are sometimes multiple channels available for things like descriptive audio tracks as well, though those aren't as universal. And then we have another requirement, which is not really accessibility, which is called emergency alert system. And this is, again, government mandated, where at any time, we can sort of take over any television broadcast in a certain local area and tell them, like, a tornado's coming or a hurricane's coming. And it absolutely has to work without flaw. So it actually requires a lot of engineering in the system. And again, if you start delivering to web browsers, well, what does that mean? Does that still make sense? Is that something that's going to be required? And to get sort of a push-style information, and how would that work? So I think those are things we have to work through. And one of the aspects of these that's interesting is that right now, a lot of those things, like the captions, like the parental control, are done by the TV manufacturer. So for example, when we have a set-top box, we don't touch the captioning through any of our software that does our guide. We just pass that through, and the television itself displays that. And the same thing with the parental, what's called the V-chip, the parental control. And the question is, what does that mean now if a TV has a web browser? Does the TV still do it underneath, like at the codec level, the subtitling, or does it actually come up through these new APIs that are coming up, like through the time track APIs? And therefore, same thing, if it's on a PC and it's a browser, is that done sort of by the browser platform itself, or does this all come up and it's done sort of in the HTML JavaScript world? Those are kind of unanswered questions that have to be decided.
I get quite depressed when I hear so much of the talk about accessibility being, because government has mandated we do this, government says we must do that. Libby, you have more to say, I think, about accessibility. Is any of it because it just makes good commercial sense, or it's because you're talking to people? Could you add a bit more about accessibility before Jeff asks this question, please? Or not, if you don't want to say anything.
Well, no. I mean, I think there's a lot more we can do. And one of the nice things about with these technologies is, you know, the kind of levels of accessibility we're talking about here exceed some of the things that have traditionally been done with television. One of the things I thought was interesting we're talking about was the audio program where, like, the background music was pulled down. That's very easy to deliver on a television. It would be very low cost for us to deliver that with all our programming. We would have to have, obviously, people have to produce that. It's nothing you can do automatically, but that would be very easy to deliver. And I think that also the ability of the interactive programs to be able to sort of deliver the annotated or captioned information in different ways for different kinds of users, or being able to highlight things, or change the size of things, are all things that haven't been able to be done traditionally with television. So I think there's a lot of new opportunities. It'd be nice if we could excel beyond those. I start with the governmental regulations, obviously, because those are the things we have to do before we're even allowed to deliver a signal at all.
That sounds very positive. Thank you. I had two questions I was going to ask you. Charles asked one of them. I wonder whether Jeff's going to ask the other one.
Very unlikely. Jeff Chaffee, W3C. So the television industry is a very diverse industry. You have content creators, and you have broadcasters, equipment manufacturers, people that make subsystems and software, and you just tossed in government requirements and regulations, and I'm sure many of these things are different by country. Pretty diverse, and I'm just trying to understand, how do I think about getting a consensus of this industry? So each of you talked through many different use cases. There were some common threads about having a television and a device on the side, or maybe a mobile device, or maybe another stationary device, or two televisions, or three televisions, or maybe no televisions because everything is on the web. So there's all sorts of different models that people have. And my head is spinning a little bit. I'm curious if the panelists have a viewpoint, you know, is there like a succinct use case that needs to be focused on by a well-defined subset of the TV industry in terms of bringing television to the web, or is it a multiple stakeholder, very complicated topic that we can't make progress unless we have each of the different kinds of stakeholders at the table? I'm just trying to understand what the scope of the effort is in focusing on web and TV together.
Does somebody want to take that, or shall I pick on someone? I know who I'm going to pick on. If you don't speak, I'm going to ask you anyway. Don Young, I think this is for you.
Yeah, I think as far as I believe, there's a consensus that we as the whole TV industry has some urgent need for some minimal spec that can be a platform for so-called smart TV. And actually, there are existing works. And so what we really need to do here is to unify those existing specs and on on fragmenting them quickly before it's too late. I think there's a consensus, at least that kind of work.
I'd also add that I think that there's a way to liaison with other groups, and I'd actually recommend that I think there needs to be a liaison with at least the DLNA as one group, which is a group where I think the television manufacturers, we're both members, television manufacturers and people involved in TV broadcasting delivery, satellite, cable, IPTV, are all participating. And that's not a standards writing group, but that's a group that kind of picks up sets of standards. And so I think a liaison there would make a lot of sense in terms of coordinating these so that what the W3C does can sort of drive in requirements in a more unified way instead of having to pull it all together yourselves.
Thank you, Mark. Yusuke, you looked as if you wanted to add something. Okay. Please do.
Oh. From the content provider viewpoint, there is a food value chain in TV industry, and in many countries, the shape of value chain is different. I think we can reach agreement, or we can build a consensus about one TV or new TV with HTML5 or one web concept. I've examined the DVB MHP, the Java-based set-top box digital television technology in 5 years ago with some microsystems and Philips. Then we compared BML, that is XHTML 1.1 based DTV specification in Japan. We thoroughly examined these two specifications, but we reached the consequence that both language has the same ability to realize use cases on digital television. So I think the constraints from the resource the audience, the viewing style of audience makes something like a Turing complete of language for television. So there are many language, many syntax. There are many syntax, but in the heart, the semantics is all the same. So
I'm trying to wrap you up because I've got to move on. Okay.
Okay? Thank you. We can agree with the semantics of the in TV industries.
Thank you, Yosuke. I'm going to close the queue after this last question, please. Oh, Kaz, sorry, quickly, yes?
A few additions to this topic. So, as Jeff mentioned, the TV industry is diverse. And, so the requirements differ by country. And so, please note that. So, this first workshop was held in Japan. That's true. And we are planning to hold another second workshop in Europe next year, probably in March. And also, currently, there are four proposed candidates of co-chairs for the IG, TV IG, one from LG, one from Tomodachi, and one from Opera, and one from NTT Communication Company, and the last guy is a liaison contact for ITUT as well. And so we are also planning to contact key people from various broadcasters from many countries, including Europe, Japan, Korea. So that kind of contacting key person is very important in this situation, I think. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Kaz. Just quickly, we need to move this quickly now. Please, your question, sir.
My name is 大輔福の Jig JP Mobile Browser Vendor. First of all, there are many complicated problems with web and TV, but first of all, how about do we define TV streaming protocol for HTML5 video tag? If there is, we created TV program with Twitter, games, chat, any applications. Please give me a comment to create TV streaming protocol.
If I understood your question correctly, I think I can answer it. You're talking about HTTP streaming?
No.
Then I didn't understand it correctly.
On TV.
Yes.
On TV, HTML5 video tag.
Yes.
With TV, TV broadcasting video.
Yes.
Including HTML5 video tag.
Right. So I want to broadcast some HTML5 content alongside the video stream, which could be separated out and done stuff in other devices. I'm doing a better job than me. No, I'm sorry, sir. I've obviously misunderstood your question twice now, and I'm embarrassed to do it a third time. So I don't want to do that. I'm sorry. But the answer to you, I think the fundamental answer to your question, you mentioned about what standards are we going to do. That's where we need to wrap this up and end on, because we have an interest group forming now. And the idea of the interest group on the web and TV, put your vector in as you wish, will be the interest group is going to define the charter for the working group. And we very much hope there will be a full working group on this starting within the first half of 2011. And so whatever the particular things we need standard APIs to make this one TV so that devices synchronize with each other, communicate with each other, so that the user gets an augmented TV experience, whether they're sitting on the sofa watching TV at home in the traditional way, or accessing bits of TV on the move, whatever it may be. So that's what the interest group is about. If this kind of application is of interest to you as a browser manufacturer, or a consumer electronics manufacturer, or a TV content provider or an infrastructure provider, that's what the interest group is about. Kaz is going to be leading this in terms of getting the interest group together and hopefully developing a charter for the working group if it goes as we hope it will. I have one scar on the back of the mobile web group, which I was involved with for a long time, is when we got together at Dan Applequist's office in Vodafone in 2005, NTT Docomo turned up and said, "Where were you 5 years ago? We wanted you to do this best practice work 5 years ago, or was it 10 years ago? We've been ahead of you for ages." I'm very glad that this interest group is forming. I'm very glad that we have such important players in the room already. Others I know are in the room who haven't taken part in the panel. Very importantly, we're very welcoming to those companies who've joined us here at TPAC today. It's critical. Timing is very critical. Everyone's talking about HTML5. I think everyone who's been on the stage is talking about HTML5. We need to get the bus moving. We need to get the interest group up and going. We need to look towards the working group. We are out of time, but does anyone have anything they really need to say before we close? Kaz, you look like you want to say something.
Please join the IG.
Okay.
Yes.
Seriously, join the IG, which will be out there. And if you didn't get an answer to your question, sir, I'm sorry. That's my fault. It's not their fault. So thank you all. There's refreshments out there now. Please be back here at 16:15 for the final session, which for Americans means 4:15 p.m. Thank you.